everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined as always when we talk about the retro shows with Sondra. We're a little bit late this week again, we do apologise, but we are going to be recording a bunch of stuff while Sondra's over here, so we should be back on track. Hi Sondra, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Kenny. Just getting excited for my trip to Glasgow, getting excited for the Chris Jericho tour that's coming up next week. It's less than a week until our first show, which is crazy.
Now, the difference is, I'm going to give you two trains of excitement. There is the I work on Inside the Ropes shows excitement that you just heard, and there is, oh, fuck, I'm promoting this show.
See, Kenny has a very different level of needing to stress before these things. Like, I'm just getting ready for an overseas flight, which, you know, is stressful for me, but I don't really have to do that much. I just have to make sure I have enough stuff with me so that I am clothed and whatever. I understand that this week is like absolutely crazy for you.
It's insane. Like, even today, I had to take a nap there for an hour just to stop having to do things. So that was fun. But you know, it's listen, at the end of the day, we get to a Chris Jericho show. I'm not going to complain. It's fun. But we're here to talk about the May 11th episode of Raw is War. You can check out last week's episode, May 4th, where Sondra shocked the world by enjoying Mick Foley and Terry Funk, which I was not expecting.
It was better than I expected it to be. I still think that Terry Funk looks like he can barely move and should not be wrestling, but
still very accurate. So we're here to talk about the May 11th, 1998 episode from Baltimore, Maryland, home of James Ellsworth.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
We get told at the top of the show that we're going to see footage of DX going to the headquarters of WCW in Atlanta, and WCW calling the cops on them. So this is the one, you've not really heard about this one, right?
No, I didn't realize that it was a more than one time thing.
Almost like the narrative is that it wasn't really this like defining thing. It was just like, why don't we go to their offices this week?
I mean, it kind of seems like, okay, last week it was a funny joke and everyone hears about what they did last week. But this week it's like, why are they going to the offices? I mean, nothing happens throughout the episode. It's just them being there, essentially. Like, it's not interesting or funny.
It feels like it might get interesting and then it doesn't ever get interesting. But
no, because they're like, they called the cops. They were threatened to go to jail. But they just show up. Like, Like, I just don't care.
So we open the show with Vince McMahon coming down to the ring. He's looking pretty kind of laid back tonight. He's not, you know, he's got a little button undone in the shirt. He's got a smile on his face. The crowd are chanting for Austin. And Vince says that he's going to force Austin to compete in a tag team match. Doesn't tell us who his opponents are going to be or his partner's going to be. But he does introduce the man who made the kind of sacrifice that it takes to become the number one contender. It's Dude Love. And as the Dude Love theme plays, we see Mick Foley coming to the ring wearing a suit jacket, sweatpants that I guess are in line of colour with the suit, a shirt, tie, fake teeth, and a ponytail. I guess let's just unpack his look first.
I mean, he's straightened his hair as well. Did you notice it's like, it's straight and sleek and he shaved a goatee so he doesn't have his big beard anymore?
He also carried a copy of the Wall Street Journal.
Because of course he did. I mean, he doesn't look like Dude Love. He looks like man in what he thinks is a suit, but it's not quite a suit. I mean, like you say, he's essentially wearing sweatpants that are a similar color to the suit jacket. So it's not like he really, it's the most Mick Foley suit ever though, right? It's what Mick Foley thinks is dressing up, but it's just kind of a horrible failure.
It's exactly what you'd expect if Mick Foley tried to dress up in a suit. Really?
Yes.
So he comes
in. I mean, the suit jacket is like sort of checked, but not really in a classy way.
It's like, it's not committed to being checked, but it's kind of checked.
Yeah, it almost looks like a weird, like, it almost looks like it was corduroy or something from far away, and then I realized that it was checks, but it's not really. Nothing about it works. Nothing about it works at all.
So he talks about how he...
Which makes it perfect for Mick Foley.
Of course. So he is a... He talks about how, you know, he's a well-educated man. He speaks four different languages. He reads Greek tragedies. He's a lover of women, leader of men. He's a surprisingly good dancer. He's the king of hardcore wrestling. And as Austin's going to find out it over the edge, he's the world's toughest son of a bitch. Future WWF champion, Dude Love. Him and Vince shake hands. Dude is just, you know, smiling, and so is Vince. And then at one point, Mick Foley says, seemed like he had lost his smile, which I love that reference. Managed to get the Sean reference in there. Dude Love wants a hug. Vince does it. Then they have a surprise for us. They announce that over the edge, for Dude Love versus Stone Cold, we're going to have a guest timekeeper, the esteemed Gerald Briscoe. And here comes Gerald in his suit, looking very happy with himself that he is going to timekeeper a match. The fans are not feeling it. Vince then says they have a guest ring announcer. It's Pat Patterson. So Pat Patterson comes out. JR refers to Pat as a long-time McMahon loyalist. And there's going to be a special guest referee. Vince says the man stands tall amid an abyss of mediocrity. His sheer physical presence is nothing short of awe-inspiring. And the guest referee is a man of principle to the extent that he can swim in a sea of temptation and never run amok. So we're not building this guy up at all.
No, not at all.
In any way, shape, or form.
I really wish that Gerald Briscoe had been the guest ring announcer and Pat Patterson had been the guest timekeeper instead, because then we could get Gerald Briscoe speaking more.
But Pat Patterson speaking more is a delight as well, because he can't
That's
pronounce.
That's true. That is very true.
So Pat Patterson eventually has to announce, which of course is the best thing. And I can't remember how he mucks it up, but he basically says, the best there is, the best that was there, and the best that's going to be there, or whatever it was. Like, he completely fucked up.
I mean, he does say the best there was, the best there is, I think. But he definitely mixes it up and gets confused partway through Bret Hart's catchphrase.
And I remember watching this at the time and kind of being like, God, I hope it's Vince. I hope Vince is the referee, because of course the ridiculousness would only go to that degree. And when Vince was in the ring, you were like, well, Vince is in the ring, so who's it going to be? And then Vince goes to the back and he comes back out in... Well, I guess you must know this as the Sheamus referee muscle shirt.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen Vince McMahon in this shirt as well before. So I always think of it as, you know, the Vince McMahon shirt. It's the tightest referee shirt that a referee shirt can be, with the arms cut off so that he can show off those guns, right? Because he's Vince McMahon. And it, you know, it's just the most Vince thing. I love that the referee shirt still has the collar, but has the arms cut off. It's quite a look. It is quite a look. And Vince is just posing and raising his arms, and eventually Dude Love's music plays, and it kind of goes on for a while and got really awkward.
The music plays for a long time, but they all have their arms up together. JR shouts, it's a conspiracy. How can Austin overcome all these odds? Vince then hits the corners, mocking Austin, doing the Austin pose. And that's so the deck has been stacked. Now, did you know that there is a match where Vince is the referee, Patterson's the ring announcer, and Briscoe's the timekeeper?
I knew that Vince was going to be a guest referee at some point. So when they started banging on about a referee, I thought, okay, this is probably it.
But you did not know the glory of Patterson and Briscoe also being guest people.
No, I did not know that they were going to be involved. Although I've never really understood, oh, we have a guest ring announcer. Oh, we have a guest timekeeper. What is that even going to do? I mean, I guess the guest timekeeper would have been in charge of ringing the bell, so that position can kind of fuck with someone. But a guest ring announcer, how much is that going to affect anything? Like, they're going to introduce you. How dastardly.
What if what if Pat Patterson introduces Steve Austin in a very underutilized way? That could put you off your game.
Apparently so. Maybe it's mind games. Maybe it's mind games, Kenny. Can I just say something about Dude Love here?
Sure.
So one of my issues when I've been listening to, you know, other podcasts that cover this time frame, kind of to get other people's opinions on it after I see the shows, of course, because I don't want spoilers. And one of the narrative things that people keep talking about is corporate Dude Love. And I would just like to posit that this is the first week of corporate Dude Love, because I've heard people talk about Dude Love from the match at the last pay-per-view that we just saw that I can't, right? Unforgiven. and how Stone Cold Steve Austin fought corporate Dude Love. I don't think that was corporate Dude Love. When JR is banging on about a conspiracy theory and saying that Dude Love was in league with Vince McMahon all along with all of this stuff, I don't know that that's true. I feel like after Dude Love fought Terry Funk last week, then he and Vince kind of made up, and now he's fully in the corporate, like, clique or whatever. He's fully in with Patterson and Briscoe and Vince. But I guess I don't like the historical narrative that Dude Love was corporate up until this point, because it doesn't really seem like he was in Vince McMahon's pocket. It seems like Vince gave him a number one contendership opportunity that one time, but then he also made him wait for, or he made him work to get another number one contendership spot shot. So I guess as I'm watching it, I'm just seeing it differently than the historical narrative that's presented to me. And it's just one of those observations that I thought it's worth bringing up.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would have never said that corporate Dude Love was around before this. I think this is definitely the debut of him.
I agree with you. Because I've heard multiple places and, you know, read multiple things where people are like, oh yeah, and then when Dude Love fought, you know, when corporate Dude Love fought Steve Austin at Unforgiven, I'm like, no, corporate Dude Love did not fight Steve Austin at Unforgiven. Dude Love fought Steve Austin at Unforgiven, and it was annoying.
Yeah, and I think when it finally came to the point where Dude Love had kind of fully turned, it's better, because at first you're kind of like, well, why is he Dude Love? But then now it makes sense because Vince wanted him to be Dude Love, because that's more of a Vince McMahon character than Mankind.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I'm with you.
And I think Dude Love is actually becoming a more interesting character here, because, you know, he's in with Vince, he's in the whole corporate clique, but it's basically he's finally standing up for himself and doing what he needed to do to elevate himself. Because like he said, when, you know, everyone wanted Cactus Jack, and then he was finally Cactus Jack and everyone chanted Austin's name. So now he's like, well, fuck it. If I'm not even going to be able to give the people what they want and make them love me by giving them what they asked for themselves, then I guess I just have to go a different direction and elevate myself in another way. And I think that's interesting character motivation.
Mike, yeah, the thing is, since WrestleMania, Mick Foley has been really, really good as a character, because every week it's just, there's another layer. He's an onion, Sondra.
He is an onion, like Shrek.
We got some footage of DX driving their Jeep to the WCW offices. DX doesn't fear no trespassing signs. Security tried to give them, like, security seemed fine with them, which they don't really understand why. The cops are going to come to meet them. And then when they get back in the arena, JR says that WCW's vice president, Nick Lambros, was the one who called 911. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, none of this matters. It's real stupid. But, and they keep banging on about giving free tickets away to Monday Nitro as well.
Oh yeah, that stupid thing they said a couple weeks ago that wasn't even true.
They just keep mentioning it. You missed one of my very, very favorite interactions, though, is Kevin Kelly.
So what I was going to do is do both these at the same time. I'm not going to miss it, don't worry. So this is sandwiched in the middle of two Kevin Kelly segments, which, you know, we're a fan of here.
Kevin Kelly for Hall of Fame.
Kevin Kelly is standing waiting for Steve Austin to appear. And as he's waiting, Sable walks by him. Because obviously, you know, Sable's got stuff to do with Mark Merrill. Kevin Kelly tries to get a word with her, and Sable just has no time for him whatsoever.
The look of disdain that Sable gives Kevin Kelly was one of my favorite things of this episode. And she's just like, not now. Poor Kevin Kelly. He's just trying to get the scoop, Kenny.
He is, and then he's standing there when we come back from this DX thing, hoping to get Austin, and a door rises. He thinks it's Austin. It's Al Snow and Head.
I was so excited. Okay, I did not know that Al Snow was showing up this week, and I am so happy about it. And Al Snow's talking to Head, and Head apparently is not very good at giving directions, because, you know, it's a mannequin head. And he's like, I can't find my seats. Kevin Kelly looks baffled by all of this. And this is proper Al Snow, like, because I didn't know if Al Snow had Head the whole time when he came back. Apparently Head is just there. There's no explanation as to why he's carrying around a mannequin head. I love it. Al Snow was one of the three wrestlers that I could have named before I started watching wrestling, because I always just thought it was hilarious that there was a wrestler called Al Snow, because you have The Rock and you have Triple H and you have Stone Cold Steve Austin and you have, you know, all these really big burly men, and then Al Snow. Like, I just remember asking my friend in in like my freshman year of high school when she was showing me videos of The Rock. I was like, why the fuck is someone named Al Snow? I love Al Snow. I'm so excited about this. And he's absolutely mental.
So he has arrived. Kevin Kelly is just like, what the fuck? Because Kevin Kelly is ready to do his fucking, you know, Barbara Walters moment with Steve Austin. And instead, he's got Al Snow and Head to contend with. So he manages to get Al Snow and Head to kind of go around the other side of the building. And this is the WWF debut of Al Snow and Head.
I mean, there's no explanation. He's just insane.
Well, because it's a man with a mannequin head. I think immediately you know what you're getting with him. A mentalist. Yeah.
Oh, I'm not saying that I have any problem with this whatsoever, because I sure don't, because I think Al Snow is great on this episode.
I would concur. I think he's great. So up next, we get the final appearance of Vader versus Barry Windham. Barry Windham's final appearance against Vader, sorry. Barry Windham is now with Jim Cornette and the New Midnight Express again, for whatever reason. This is Vader's in-ring return on TV. Vader's wearing a V-neck t-shirt over his usual gear for some reason. Don't know why. Maybe he thought he'd got a bit of fat or something.
I mean, it's Vader. Like,
that's true. That's true.
He's been Vader for a long time. Is anyone really going to notice a difference?
We do get told that we're going to see Vader versus Kane over the Edge in a mask match.
Yeah, so the loser has to unmask, which is interesting.
So loser has to unmask, but luckily Vader just there for about two minutes, whips the piss out of Barry Windham. Vader bombs him, that's it. After the match, bombastic Bob Bodacious Bart tried to attack Vader, but Vader just bails. Vader just leaves.
He does do a really, really terrible back body drop attempt to Bodacious Bart, and it looks like Bart just gets stuck up in the air for a while. Vader doesn't look great here, I didn't think.
This is the beginning of the downfall of Vader.
Yeah, and I wish that I didn't know that Vader's last run was sad, because I am excited to see Vader back.
It's better that you know his last run is sad, so then you're not like...
So then I'm not excited about it.
Yeah, because if you were excited about Vader and you saw how it ended up for him, would be a good place to be.
Yeah, because, I mean, I know that it's not going to go so well for Vader. And in this match, I mean, there was a sunset flip attempt that really didn't go so well. Even Vader's standing splash looked a bit shit. Like, it's not great. And, I mean, I, of course, was having a lot of feelings about Barry Windham in this match, because you did warn me that this is the last appearance of Barry Windham on Raw. And Barry Windham looks like shite in his brown chaps, and he doesn't even have his headband, I don't think. And I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss him so much.
I mean, I was expecting it's almost like you're too sad to give him a real eulogy.
It's difficult to put into words what Barry Windham has meant to me on Retro Raw. I mean...
Fuck's sake.
From episode one, when I found out he was the stalker, which made no sense whatsoever because he was a babyface and women are screwed. We're playing the stalkers theme to do the outro to this episode because we have to send Barry Windham off in style. And then for some reason he was a blackjack, which didn't really work very well, but he was strangely the worst blackjack out of him and Bradshaw. And when you're the worst blackjack out of someone in Bradshaw, that's never good. And then he changed the color of his chaps and joined the NWA. And I still don't understand why he's back with the NWA, because I thought he had split from the NWA. But for some reason, Cornette and the Midnight Express are out here for his last appearance. They knew he was going. They must have known he was going, needed to say goodbye to Barry Windham. He looks like he's 76 at the ripe old age of 30.
He does look like the most atrocious 37-year-old I've ever seen. And I live in Glasgow, where, like, people like put padlocks on trolleys.
I mean, that was in Paisley, but yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. So we then find out that Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to be on Celebrity Deathmatch, which is, you know, fun. Steve Austin arrives to the arena in his car, and Kevin Kelly tries to let Austin know what's happened. None of this is positive information for Steve Austin.
I'm just saying, Kevin Kelly is, he has balls, right? Like, he is the one who's like, All right, so Austin, by the way, Gerald Briscoe and Pat Patterson and Vince McMahon all involved in your Over the Edge match. Also, you have to fight in tag action tonight. Also, we don't know who your partner is. Also, we don't know who you're fighting. Kevin Kelly is willing to impart this information to Stone Cold Steve Austin just to get Stone Cold Steve Austin's reaction and to get a story. Kevin Kelly for Hall of Fame.
He's great. And then Austin asks him where Vince is. Kevin Kelly has no idea. Austin then says, since he's no help, he'll take the mic. And he takes the mic and he just shouts, give me a bit of slack! And then they don't give him any slack to the mic, so he just drops the mic and goes looking for Vince. And Steve Austin is Bay, is the answer.
Is this the first time he references them as Stooges? Because he says they don't even qualify as Three Stooges, they're three jackasses?
I think it is. I think on TV it's the first time they've done it, so...
Because we've been calling them Stooges because we know, but I don't think they've actually referenced them as Stooges before.
No, I think this is the first time they've been referenced on TV as Stooges. So, up next is the feud that kills my soul and will continue to. Road Warrior Hawk with Animal and Sonny in the corner against Skull with 8-Ball. JR mentions that neither LOD nor DOA will be able to get their hands on DX Over the Edge. Instead, the Nation will face DX in six-man tag team action at Over the Edge.
So the tag titles are not being contested at Over the Edge is basically the point of this.
Yeah.
Because they're just in a random six-man tag instead for reasons?
I mean, I assume now that Owen Hart has some backup, he wants to take on DX.
I guess, but couldn't they have China and X-Pac and Triple H fight them and then the tag titles could still be contested?
They could, but, you know, that would take us away from the glory that is LOD and DOA.
Right.
Hawk gets pinned by an inside cradle in 2.5 minutes because 8-Ball and, 8-Ball and Skull do the Bella Twin switch.
Nazi twin magic.
Nazi twin magic. There's a t-shirt. any thoughts on this atrocious feud that I detest?
I'm glad that DOA have their bikes back. That makes me happy. And apparently the sponsorship is not really going on because Michael Cole is not banging on about Titan bikes or whatever, but the bikes were back. Hawk versus Skull is terrible. There's a brawl. Animal still has that thing where he can't compete in singles action, right? Is that why it's Hawk?
I don't know, Sandra. I don't know. I don't care about any of this. Any question you ask me about this, I'm just going to be baffled and annoyed I have to talk about it.
I mean, it's very bad. And apparently
when I was like 13, right, and Jamie and I would watch WWF, there, you know, we would pretty much accept anything. Even we knew DOA and LOD was shit.
It's very bad. And apparently none of the commentators didn't even notice the Nazi twin magic. Because Michael Cole is just amazed that Skull rolled up Hawk, who kicked out on three, of course, because Hawk.
They refused to lose. They had, yeah. Before WCPW had a pay-per-view name, Hawk had a finish.
Exactly. And then, you know, JR's kind of like, I don't know. I think that might be 8-Ball. And Michael Cole's just like, I feel like this feud is far from over, JR. And I'm not very excited about it. It's not great. I feel like I want to like it just based on the fact that you hate it so much. And also I want to like LOD, but for some reason it is bad.
Yep. 100%. So then we have more footage of DX in Atlanta. They're now at CNN Center and they can't really film anything there. DX tells
Triple H just looks generally confused by proceedings. China has a really neat Nike hat though.
She does. They tell the security they want to talk to Ted Turner because they're dear friends. That doesn't happen. They then crotch chop with fans and that's that.
I just don't understand the point of this. Like, are they meant to be edgy? They're not invading anything. They're not doing anything. They're just there.
I guess the idea at this point was that to put it into context, if you're watching these shows and there is still competition, then the idea is that if there's footage of them showing up on the opposite places, you know, turf, that you would watch that no matter what happens or no matter how it plays out.
I guess.
But
I don't know. I just thought it was kind of boring. I was way more excited about the Edge vignette.
Edge comes up. He's hanging out in subways. He's pissed off about some stuff. Edge is
the
coming.
The truth that you deceive, the lie that you believe, the god to which you pray, the devil you must repay. Bullet in the gun, the pain from which you run. It's a silencing machine to end all your dreams. None of this makes sense, but I don't care because it's Edge.
As the key of whether Sonya likes someone or not is when it doesn't make sense with DX, it's the most boring thing ever. When it doesn't make sense with someone she likes, she makes a poem out of it. So,
well, no, that's what they said.
No, I know, but you took the time to read it for the listeners. I'm just expressing that you like Edge.
I do like Edge a lot. I'm so excited. Edge and El Snow on the same episode.
Takemi Shinoku is smoking cigars with Bradshaw in a car. So basically, Bradshaw is teaching Takemi Shinoku how to drive, which is as baffling as it sounds. Taka says something, gets bleeped. Bradshaw laughs. I guess he's becoming a mini Bradshaw now. It's kind of adorable in a weird way. And then Taka has no clue what he's doing. Almost runs over some fans. And then when they come back inside the building, Kai and Tai jump them.
Why did Bradshaw think it was a great idea to teach Takemi Shinoku how to drive in a convertible with the top down in the rain?
I don't think they knew it was raining.
Okay, because it's definitely raining, because when they come back in, the car is all wet.
But I don't think they knew it was going to be raining, so, you know, he just didn't check the weather channel before he left.
I mean, he should have just stepped outside and been like, maybe this is a bad idea. But whatever, I mean, it's Bradshaw and I don't really care. Takemi Shinoku is kind of adorable, though. I guess they're trying to...
Their double act was kind of adorable.
It was kind of adorable, and there's the whole, oh, hilarity, because a foreign guy is swearing. Isn't that so cute, is basically what they're going for.
So we then go to Farouk versus Jeff Jarrett. Farouk has some new music. It is crap.
It's quite bad, yep. It says something about respect by any means necessary, and I just feel like he's kind of like Roman Reigns, not being able to let go of his faction.
Farouk and Roman Reigns, who would have thought that comparison we'd get this week? Steve Blackman is with Farouk while Tennessee Lee's with Jeff Jarrett, so of course it's just...
I have a big bone to pick with this match. Also, why is Jeff Jarrett's outfit not lighting up, and why doesn't he have his horse?
Listen, you can't have motorcycles and horses here.
Okay, I would be willing to forego the horse, but why is the jacket not lighting up? He's just wearing a white jacket with gold lamé.
Would you put all of your, you know, style and pizzazz into having a match with Farouk?
I mean, I would try to jazz up a match with Farouk. Steve Blackman is out there to suck like 12 charisma points from the world. I mean, we need a light-up jacket here to save it.
It is true. We do need one. Sadly, we don't get one. Luckily, it literally lasts less than 2 minutes because Farouk is beating up Jarrett. Eventually, Jarrett ends up on the floor. Tennessee Lee tries to distract Steve Blackman, but then he turns back around and Blackman decks Jarrett. Farouk then hits the Dominator, and then Cam and Mark Henry come in and attack Farouk, and there's a DQ. Steve Blackman's helping out Farouk, but then Jarrett, of course, helps get the numbers name. Jarrett hits Blackman with his own nunchucks, and Jarrett continues to assault Blackman with his nunchucks as referees come down to make the save, and I don't care about Steve Blackman and Jeff Jarrett.
It makes me laugh that every time Steve Blackman does a kick, they call it a martial arts kick. And he looks so proud of himself for not falling over. But really, he doesn't even look proud of himself because he can't move his face. But he looks like he's, you know, like he pauses to kind of take in the moment of the fact that he did a kick without falling over.
Oh, Steve Blackman. Jesus Christ.
I don't really care about this either.
We get one of the best ads of all time for the Briscoe Brothers Body Shop. It's just the best. Because, of course, if Vince is getting Briscoe to do his dirty work for him, Briscoe's going to get some publicity out of it. So
yeah, might as well.
Briscoe Brothers Body Shop, Sandra, in case you need any auto repairs in the Tampa area.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I need auto repairs in the Tampa area. It would be a ways to travel for me just to fix my car. But, you know, bless them. Bless them for getting this free advertising. I wonder how this did affect business for Briscoe Brothers Body Shop.
Oh, I bet you they got loads of shit at that point.
They must have, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Austin comes out to the ring. He hasn't found Vince. Since he's put in a tag match, he doesn't have a partner or opponent. He feels he's owed some answers. And then Vince pops up on the screen. No, none of them are giving Austin any answers. They do the whole, like, one of them's covering the ears, one's covering the eyes, one's covering the mouth. And then Austin says, you can cover up your ears, eyes, and mouth, but you can't cover up your ass. When all's said and done, that's exactly where he's going to stick the WWF Championship line and Championship belt. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so. And JR said, I might get fired for saying this, but the treatment of the WWF champion is very unfair. So it's funny, they were kind of very slowly, JR is starting to get on Austin's side a little bit. And it makes sense, because even though Austin stunned JR back in September, and Austin's been a dick to him, like, Austin has been getting this horrendous treatment from Vince for, like, what, a month now? Maybe a month?
And I think about a month.
And you can see JR starting to kind of cave and be like, you know, this isn't fair. You might not like the guy, but he doesn't deserve this. Like, he doesn't deserve this level of stuff happening. So I thought JR just coming out of that kind of subtle line was quite interesting. But yeah, Austin just kind of setting the scene for the main event.
Yeah, which makes sense. It always cracks me up just how obsessed wrestlers are with other people's asses. Like,
in what other industry is that going to be? Like, I don't get how it's a good insult.
It's not. Like, and it doesn't even make sense. Like, because they're doing the whole see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil thing, which is, it's a pretty funny picture, to be fair. But, you know, you can't cover up your ass. Like, they can. They can, actually. But I don't know. It's just everyone's very obsessed with asses in wrestling, especially in this day and age of 1998, it seems, because you have Stone Cold Steve Austin, who wants everybody's ass. Triple H always wants a piece of ass. You have Mr. Ass on the roster. Asses everywhere.
And then soon enough, we're going to have Billy Gunn having I'm an Ass Man as his theme tune. So, you know.
Cannot wait.
Sable is stretching backstage for her confrontation with Mark Meadow. Which leads us into a Val Venus promo. It's kind of a montage of all his vignettes, almost like Val Venus is coming, Sandra.
Val Venus is coming. I felt that this was lazy. I did not want a compilation. I wanted new sex puns from Val Venus. This was just a montage of all of the previous Val Venus videos that we've seen. You know, he's just talking about when he penetrates inside the World Wrestling Federation. Let's just say it'll be a scream and get your rest now and all that stuff. And, you know, it's nice, but I've seen it before, and I would like a new porn parody.
It's fair. We enter the war zone with JR and the King, and it is Sable versus Marvelous Mark Merrill. Lawler said he took some Viagra before the segment. So, yeah, yep. There's that. Meadow picks up Sable, threatening the
I like how JR goes, we're live on TSN tonight, King. That's in Canada. Mind your manners. Like, because they're airing in Canada, Lawler needs to behave himself.
So Sable is, you know, Sable wanted this confrontation. Not that I'm trying to take Marmero's side here, but she wants the confrontation. Meadow picks her up, threatening the TKO, but he puts her down gently because he is a gentleman. And then she kicks him in the balls and gives him a Sable bomb.
He's trying to do the right thing. I mean, he was being fairly demeaning to her, though. You know, he's just like, especially because, I mean, that's not all that happened. Because Sable comes out and then, you know, Mark Miro's like, see what I could have done to you. I could have done this to you. Ha ha ha. And he's like goading her and saying, I want you to apologize to me for trying to ruin my career in the WWF. And so it's not like he just picked her up and then put her down. It was like he was also trying to goad her into apologizing for something that she should not be apologizing for. Because all she's done is, you know, be more interesting than him.
I mean, I think he's pretty interesting.
I actually quite like Mark Mirren.
I love him.
So can we just unpack Sable's outfit? Because
it's not really a great combat gear.
No. It was funny. Mr. Sandra was watching this with me, part of it, and he just goes, he literally walked into the room and goes, eesh. And I was like, yes, dear, what is the problem? He's like, the size of her rack is disconcerting, and also that suit looks terrible. It looks like a bathing suit made out of garbage bags.
She didn't pick the right suit, but she, I mean, did you find the Sable bomb on Mark Meadow impressive?
I mean, I've seen this clip. I was actually wondering if this was going to be when she hits the Sable bomb on Mark Miro, because I thought I remembered her hair being in a full French braid and puffier in the front, so apparently I was misremembering it.
Or this is not the only time she hits the Sable bomb on Mark Meadow.
Or this is not the only time she hits a sable bomb on Mark Nero, which is probably the case. Because I kind of thought it would come in the middle of a match or to end a match or that they have a match or something. And this was not a match. This was just a confrontation. I just want to know why Sable has such big kick pads. Like, I found the kick pads even more disconcerting than her chest.
You're not, this isn't a euphemism, right?
No. Actual kick pads.
Okay. Well, I mean, she's not experienced in combat. She's new to all of this, Sandra.
It's just the kick pads were so thick. Like, they looked ridiculous.
I mean, but Sable is ridiculous.
Sable is ridiculous in all of the ways, and I think that's why she works. But I mean, JR is like, she ain't got no business trying to fight a man and all this stuff. I mean, I think more the issue is that Mark Miro is a trained competitor who is a wrestler and who is a boxer, and Sable hits some boards and does some training montages, right? So theoretically, Mark Miro should be able to take on Sable if they're actually going to be in a confrontation. But it was pretty fun, though. And Sable's wave after she does the, she kicks him in the balls and hits him with the Sable bomb and whatnot, her waving at him, because he has been a dick to her. So it's kind of nice to see her get some comeuppance on him.
And it's funny as well, because this is like one of the longest running feuds in WWF. And this goes back to like October. So they're still managing to make it kind of interesting.
And I appreciated that Sable, at least when Mark Miro had her up for the TKO, she was trying to hit him in the back, like, and act like she was trying to fight out of it. She did it very badly, but bless her for trying, I guess. She really is, like, I'm back to my original stance that she is the original Eva Marie.
Next thing, JR and Law are at commentary, and all of a sudden the Undertaker appears in street clothes. And he is pissed at Jerry Lawler. He backs up Lawler, tears away his headset, punches him into the ring, gives him a choke slam, picks him up for a tombstone, but the lights go out. Here comes Kane and Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer says, he's going to prove once for all he is Kane's father next week. And then the corners get set on fire, and when the lights come back on, Undertaker just turns and looks at Jerry Lawler, who's trying to get up, and tombstones the shit out of him. He deserved it, so good. I'm glad he got tombstoned. It was good. I enjoyed it. What did you think of chapter 487 in the installment of Kane, The Undertaker, and Paul Bearer?
I mean, Jerry Lawler was so incredibly annoying during all of Sable versus Mark Miro. He just sounds like an erect Muppet, like, the entire time. Like, hee-hee! I took Viagra! A tits! Bleh! Like, I hate him. And so, if there's any way to get me to like The Undertaker for a moment, him battering the shit out of Jerry Lawler was definitely a pleasant way to do it.
Lawler bumps so well.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when he bumps, it's like he makes every move and everything he gets done look so good.
Oh, 100%. This was great. This was really great. I don't like the performers involved, but this was great. And I like, Paul Bearer. I just don't know how much longer we can go on with just, Paul Bearer and Kane and The Undertaker and talking about him being his father and stuff. And apparently next week he's going to prove that he's Kane's father. And
all I'm going to say to you is we are still in Undertaker Kane territory in 6 months.
That's not shocking. And I don't think it's gotten too stale or anything at this point.
The only thing that gets stale later on, I think. Because I actually think that if you were to write down the story of, like, from Bad Blood, or even, like, you can go back to SummerSlam or something, I guess, because actually the story of Bearer making Undertaker go with him was quite interesting as well. If you go from that all the way through to, like, the end of 98, say, the story is really good. The only problem is, like, Undertaker and Kane, when they actually wrestle, it's not very good.
Yeah, like, so it would be, like, way better if we didn't have to have these wrestling matches.
So it's like, can you overlook the wrestling that they have and enjoy the story elements? I guess that's going to be the test of whether I'm able to do that. So, like, I can watch a terrible 20-minute wrestling match and still be like, I like the story, just didn't like the match. But, like, it's going to depend. So that'll be interesting to see as we go. But
yeah, and it's harder for me because after that WrestleMania match, I was just kind of like, oh, now some of the fire has been taken out of this feud for me. And then we got fire put back in the feud, I guess, in the Inferno match with all the flames and the sound effects and all of that kind of stuff, which the flames and the sound effects were way more interesting than the actual wrestling going on, which isn't great. But at least Paul Bearer is still progressing the story, you know, with the whole revelation that he's Kane's father. And I mean, I like when he's like, either the truth might hurt so bad that you don't believe a single word I say, or da 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 da. And I mean, Paul Bearer has a point when he points out that the Undertaker didn't believe that Kane was alive either. And Kane ended up being alive. Kane ended up being here. So maybe Paul Bearer is telling the truth about some things. Even JR begrudgingly says that Paul Bearer has a point about this. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, Undertaker is sad about stuff. And his tear is nearly off his cheek. Did you notice that? Like,
I know he's, you know, he's suffering, Sandra.
He's suffering. There's a lot of anguish going on with the Undertaker, apparently. I still want Kane to win. I'm still mad that the Undertaker's 2-0 on him.
I'm saying nothing. After the break, Al Snow and Head take their seats at the announce table.
I love them. I love them so much.
He's not supposed to be there, so obviously Patterson and Briscoe come out and try and have security escort away. Snow says he needs to see Vince. And anyway, he just hops in the ring, poses for the crowd, and leaves.
He, like, holds Head right in front of his bum bag that he's wearing for some reason, because he's Al Snow, so of course he is. I could not love him more. I could not love this more, Kenny. It's so good. And I did think it was interesting, though, because JR's like, you know, this, you could get in trouble for this, or I could get in trouble. I don't remember who was getting in trouble. Probably everyone, just because chaos is happening and everything's gone off the rails. But Al Snow's talking to Head, and he's like, what are they going to do? Are they going to fire me? I tried to quit, and now I'm back. So it's funny that they're trying to kick him out, but he's actually saying, you know, hey, I tried to quit this company. I tried to leave, and now I'm back for some reason. Because, did you say he went to ECW? Yes, because last time we saw him, he was Leaf Cassidy.
So he went to ECW when he was still Leaf Cassidy, initially. And I'm trying to figure out how did it happen again? Because I know he definitely did the Al Snow character in ECW.
With Head?
With Head, yeah, because Head was found in ECW. So he went to ECW in 97, and then he kind of developed this character, because apparently he'd read about abnormal psychology. So he got this idea to portray a guy with a kind of schizophrenic thing, using the head as like a prop for his projection. And so he like found him, he found a mannequin head on the street near the ECW arena. And that was what part of giving the idea. So, in the storyline, I'm trying to figure out what was happening. He was doing stuff in ECW. He was at Wrestlepalooza 98, which was on May 3rd. So, yeah, so he must have just basically, yeah, so Shane Douglas beat Al Snow in the main event for the ECW World Title at Wrestlepalooza, and that was kind of his farewell match as he went back to WWF. So it's almost like he went to NXT.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So he redeveloped his character. He came up with a new gimmick. He has sort of reestablished himself. He was Bray Wyatt. Yeah, he's no longer a new rocker. He now has a mannequin head. I'm okay with this.
So,
And he's wearing the Job Squad t-shirt.
He is. That's the first time I've seen that. So, Flash Funk wear it at one point? Or was he wearing
it? It might have been Flash Funk. I can't remember. Somebody wore it, though.
Oh, yeah, because Flash Funk wore it and he did this weird tassel-y thing with it at the bottom. Anyway. So, more DX and Atlanta thing. They tell the CNN Center to suck it. They send an animated missile to blow up. See, in 1998, an animated missile blown up the CNN Center was like, ha ha ha. See, now it's like, oh my god, I've just watched Infinity War.
That's not great.
But they're now back in the arena. They're in Baltimore. Baltimore is kind of like a weird, like, it's kind of a WCW town in some ways, so there's not as huge a reaction for them. X-Pac responds to comments made by Bischoff earlier in the night on Nitro.
X-Pac is very shouty.
He is, but Bischoff, so this was a live Raw against a live Nitro. So earlier on in Nitro, Eric Bischoff had cut a promo where he refused to apologise to Sean Waltman and called him a stooge for Vince McMahon. So the crowd obviously has no idea what he's talking about, but this is Waltman responding to that.
Doesn't that just encourage you to watch Nitro?
There's nothing I'm ever going to be able to say that's going to make you understand the Monday Night Wars. It was literally like people would go back and forth all the time, every segment.
Well, no, like, I know
it was,
that. Like,
so, like, I think the idea is, like, if you were watching Nitro and then you flip over to WWF and they're responding, then I guess you want to stay with it to see what happens.
See, but then I would think, oh, if they're responding, then I wonder if Nitro's going to respond back. I would want to switch back to Nitro.
I'm really glad, like, when we lived in the UK, like, you could watch Nitro from 9 till 10, like, the first hour, and then just watch Raw. And that's why I wonder if you were a wrestling fan in 1998, I wonder if you would have been a WCW fan or a WWF fan. I think you would have still been a WWF fan.
Do you think so? Because, like, from what I hear, the undercard of WCW sounded really great with the cruiserweights and
I think you would have loved
all sorts
that,
of other stuff.
I don't think you would have liked the NWO and Hogan and Savage and all that kind of stuff.
I wouldn't have liked that at all.
I feel that you would have been a surfer. You would have been a channel surfer as well.
Yeah.
But, like, so we used to, like, we would watch Nitro from 9 till 10, and then Raw was on 10 till 12, and then during the ad breaks you'd switch over and see what's going on in Nitro. It was, like, the coolest time ever to be a wrestling fan, because there was always, like, competition of what was going on. But I can't imagine what it would have been like if I'd lived in America, and it was, you know... But then I think it would have been better living in America, because it was on a Monday night. I'm sure that one of them would have had a replay, because there wasn't a replay of Nitro in the UK. I think there was a replay of Raw, but nobody missed Raw. Like, Raw was... Everybody watched Raw in the UK, if you're a wrestling fan. Anyway, just rambling. So... Waltman responded to Bischoff's thing, saying he didn't ask for an apology from Bischoff, he just wanted Bischoff to be a man, and not just if it was convenient for him. He doesn't kiss ass in the WWF, he never did in WCW, so suck it. The Outlaws do their shtick, and then Triple H does his kind of Michael Buffer thing, talks about his dick a little bit, then Owen Hart appears at the top of the ramp.
Owen Hart actually interrupts Triple H's dick analogy, because he was just about to say something about...
Owen Hart wanted to do this forever!
Yeah, like, he's just about to say his something about his surprise for Baltimore State Bird or something. I don't know. Triple H was about to go on about his penis. And suddenly Owen Hart's music hits and he says, enough is enough and it's time for a change. And I want him to kick Triple H's ass so badly. And I don't think I'm supposed to be in that side of things. Because are DX babyfaces now? Because it seems like they're trying to be babyfaces now and I still don't like them.
This is kind of the beginning of it, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean... In my mind, Owen Hart has been screwed over by Triple H so many times and so mercilessly that I am 100% on Owen Hart's side here. So I just want Owen Hart to kick Triple H's ass. And the crowd is cheering DX and I don't appreciate it. They're the bad guys.
So then Owen Hart says he's got unfinished business with Triple H. So we're going to get Triple H versus Owen Hart. Jim Cornette has replaced Lawler in commentary.
Thank fuck.
The match actually was one of Triple H and Owen Hart's better matches than they usually have, mainly because it was short. The Nation end up getting their hands on Triple H while the ref is kind of trying to split everybody up. Then Owen tries to spin heel kick, it misses, but the Enziguri of Death kick does not. Owen then is trying to beat him, and then while the ref is Hunter grabs the ref, and then China trips up Owen, and then she then gets a chair and holds the Nation at bay. The match ends with no decision because DX gets in the ring and Slaughter and the referees and agents are trying to break everything up, and it just kind of ends with no decision. So, classic 1998 refereeing.
Yeah, and the bell doesn't even ring. I mean, I just don't understand how this match wasn't broken up beforehand, because there are definitely some things that happened behind the ref's back, but the ref definitely had to see the Nation of Domination attacking Triple H that one time. And I mean, there are very clearly shenanigans going on the entire time. And so, yeah, but this, I think I agree that this is one of the better matches. I wasn't super, super bored by this one. I still think Triple H is terrible and basically like Baron Corbin.
Do you think it maybe helped that the dynamic was better in this one?
Yeah, the dynamic was better in this one. Owen Hart seems revitalized, and I think the crowd was super, super into it. So that helps, too. But yeah, I mean, it all just kind of devolves into a brawl because 1998 and Raw. So that's fine. Cornette is saying that Owen Hart and Rocky Maivia are now co-leaders of the Nation of Domination, and I don't envision that that's going to end very well.
I love that, though, because it's like, why would Owen Hart join the Nation just to be a follower? He would join to be a co-leader.
Oh, yeah, 100%. That makes sense. And if that's Rocky's recruiting tactic, then I totally understand that. I'm just saying that it could lead to interesting dissension between Owen Hart and Rocky Maivia, and I would be down for that.
So, ever since we started watching Retro Raw, Sondra initially, had, for a long time, had problems with Goldust. I enjoyed Sondra's uncomfort at Goldust's crotch, and we had a great time discussing that over the months and years. We had, you know, the queer eight time, we had Marlena getting kidnapped, we had the Pillman stuff, we had the artist formerly known as Goldust, we had Green Eggs and Ham, we had him dressing up as Sable. There was a lot of stuff, but it was never, like, boring. It was always, like, at least there was something to talk about. And now, that is
well,
going
Triple
to...
Well, Triple H versus Goldust was fairly boring, but...
If you thought that was boring, it's going to get real boring now. Because out comes Dustin Runnels with a trash can and a gasoline thing. He's got his Goldust attire in the wig. He puts it all in the trash can, pours gasoline on it, and sets it on fire. He says that Vince McMahon has taken away his pride and dignity, and because of him and his sick imagination, Vince has caused him to lose his father, he's lost his family, all for a wig and being a freak. Since he couldn't beat Steve Austin, Vince punished him by putting him in the ring with Kane. Dustin says that he won't take this abuse anymore, and Goldust dies tonight. And then he looks at the camera with tears in his eyes and says Vince will never forget the name of Dustin.
Right. So, does Goldust remember how any of his story went, or what? Because Vince didn't cause him to lose, like, and commentary's even saying, like, I don't think that Vince is responsible for him losing his father, Dusty Rhodes. And he's talking about the heartache from losing his wife, Terry, and Dakota because of Goldust, but Terry was with him as Goldust. Like, it was when you stopped being Goldust, it was when you were the artist formerly known as Goldust, that you sent Marlena away. So none of this really makes a whole lot of sense. And I think it just kind of screams of, oh, we're trying to have a shoot promo where Dustin is more... I mean, this is basically his Tom Brandy moment.
Yes, it is. Going from the fun character to the death.
Like, Salvatore Sincere, at least he loved everybody and whatever.
I mean, the thing is, like...
He was
like,
terrible.
You have no idea how dull it's going to be to have Dustin Runnels around.
He's just a guy, right? Like, does he do anything interesting with being a guy? Because
no.
If he doesn't do anything interesting with being a guy, then you have Goldust, the terrible wrestler, but without all of the fun and makeup and terrible... I mean, I do appreciate that this segment burned his Goldust gear. I appreciate that.
I give it 6 weeks before you won that back.
I don't doubt that it's going to be terrible. I've heard that it's terrible. We'll see how terrible it is. But I guess I'm just not emotionally connected to Goldust because all of the stuff that he's done in terms of like sending Marlena away and being a dick to her and all that stuff, Goldust has been a heel. So why am I supposed to feel for him? Is he supposed to be a babyface now? Is he supposed to be making, you know, is he supposed to be tugging on my heartstrings so that I want Dustin Runnels to win the world and be a prominent wrestler in the World Wrestling Federation? Because I just don't think that's going to happen. He's been a dick who can barely wrestle.
He becomes a born-again Christian.
Right. Like, on screen?
Mm-hmm. Great. But not an interesting one. He also becomes part of a fictional group called Evangelists Against Television, Movies, and Entertainment. Do you know what the acronym for that is?
Eat what?
Eat me.
Eat me. Gotcha. So, is this like pre-Right to Censor, but way less interesting?
It's not even on the same planet.
Yeah, I'm not very excited about this. I'm not very excited about this. I mean, it seems like one of those things that could maybe try to be interesting, but every time they've changed Goldust, I mean, with the exception of the artist formerly known as Goldust, when Luna Vachon came... And we got the artist formerly known as Goldust, and he was reading Green Eggs and Ham and all of that kind of stuff. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Because he was mental, and it was great. I think he dressed as Marilyn Manson a few too many times for my liking. Like, once was funny, but a whole month of it was ridiculous. I mean, at least the gear is gone, and I don't have to look at his dick.
We'll see how it gets. We'll see how it goes. We then see Terry Funk and Too Cold Scorpio against Kai and Tai. They jump them from behind. It's the three of them. They end up kind of just, you know, basically triple teaming Terry Funk until Takamichi Noku and Bradshaw attack Kai and Tai for the DQ. It's actually more fun than you would think it would be for these guys, because, I mean, Terry Funk's almost dead, but it's still quite fun. But
Terry Funk looks like he can barely move just walking down to the ring. He should retire.
I mean, I feel like you're shouting into a vortex. That's just not good.
Oh, and I am well aware that he doesn't. I am well aware that he doesn't. But I am just saying that if I were watching this in the year 1998, I would be like, hey, sir, excuse me, sir. You can barely move, sir. You shouldn't be doing this anymore, sir. You need to retire. And that's how I feel watching Terry Funk. I think Terry Funk is great. I think he is a great performer, but he can barely move. And it's really, really uncomfortable to watch. And I don't understand how this was actually a match, because everyone was just in the ring all the time and Tim White wasn't really doing anything about it. Like, you get the idea that that Kai and Tai are actually good wrestlers and could be fun, but they're basically Japanese. Like, they are nothing more than Japanese at this point. You know, you have Yamaguchi-san coming out waving a flag and cutting a promo about dirty, disgusting, scumbag Americans or whatever, and he's introducing the new generation with a new Japanese attitude, and he acts like he's going to introduce Kai and Tai, but he doesn't really even introduce them. He's just like, you never know where, and you never know when, and they were under the ring the whole time, and they attack, And then it's just sort of a brawl for the rest of the time, because Terry Funk and Scorpio are both in the ring at the same time. Kai and Tai, all three of them, are just in the ring at the same time. I don't know why it's a handicap match. And, like, Tim White finally calls for the bell when Bradshaw comes out, because apparently that was the last straw. Eh, like, this was just kind of nothing.
It was just kind of there. But it was a fun 3 minutes. I thought it was short enough that it wasn't really offensive. I liked the continuity of Bradshaw and Taka coming out and attacking, because you would do, because they got attacked in the car earlier on. But we shall see what it all leads. We get Vince McMahon backstage talking to somebody who we can't see, saying that Austin has never had a physical specimen like that person, and we can't see who it is. Then we return.
I feel like this gave it away, kind of.
Yeah, it totally gave it away. Totally
because
gave it away.
He's building himself up the same way that he built himself up as the special guest referee. Like, if he hadn't just done that earlier in the night, then you might be like, oh, okay, maybe it's Harvey Whippleman or something and it's going to be funny. But the fact that he's speaking to someone, quote unquote, / himself, in exactly the same terms that he just described himself as referee, it's like, okay, now we're starting to understand where this is going.
Then we see Alison and Heather are still trying to get back into the building. They lost their tickets. Security tries to get rid of them. And Cornette says in commentary, this isn't WCW. There's no free tickets here.
Yeah, because they're still banging on about that.
Get over it. The Nation come out to the ring again. It's The Rock and D'Lo with Kama. The Rock gets on the mic and says that unless Austin's partner is Godzilla, he better get ready because The Rock's about to lay the SmackDown, the WWF champion. Austin's getting ready to walk out the curtain. We then see Briscoe and Patterson pretty much fueling up Vince.
Yeah, they're patting him on the back, but in a very sensual way. And at this point, JR clocks it, and he's like, don't tell me.
I love disdainful JR. There's nothing better than it.
He's great. Sarcastic JR is the best.
So we have Austin. Who is his partner going to be? It is Vince McMahon in his referee muscle shirt. In his first... I mean, I don't know if the match the match from April 13th counts, because it didn't start. Did the bell ring? I don't think the bell rung.
Can't remember.
So this is Vince McMahon's first ever match in the WWF. He stands in the apron for most of it. Austin's doing all the work. Luthes press, hitting, just going to work on the heels. But, you know, we do get a people's elbow at one point for a two count. We do get Austin getting set up for a rock bottom. And... Austin, you know, Austin kind of goes towards where you traditionally go to tag your partner, but obviously it's Vince. He then gives Vince the bird, turns back around to keep fighting, and then he turns around into a Vince McMahon clothesline.
Vince almost falls over delivering this clothesline to Austin. Did you see him trip?
is so good. Like Vince, you got one thing to do. Just clothesline. Now, the clothesline was good. But sadly, he just couldn't hold his feet after it.
He is terrible. He is really, really terrible. No, this match itself, without Vince McMahon, I quite enjoyed. I thought Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock... Kenny, funny thing. Turns out Austin and Rock, pretty good at wrestling each other.
Funny that.
You know, who knew? But also, Austin and D'Lo Brown. I kind of liked Austin and D'Lo Brown. I liked their interactions. I think D'Lo Brown's kind of good. We haven't really seen much from him. And I know, like, I've heard other people talk up D'Lo Brown and say that I'm really going to like D'Lo Brown. And, you know, we haven't seen a lot from him. But every time he's in the ring wrestling, he is quite good.
He starts to get a good summer.
Yeah, because, I mean, in terms of the members of the Nation of Domination, right, you have Mark Henry, who bear hugs, essentially, and can't do much. You have Kama Mustafa, who's Mr. Punch and Kick Man. But D'Lo Brown is actually pretty good at wrestling, and I would like to see more of him. And so, I mean, if you take the whole Vince McMahon shenanigans out of this match, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I did get annoyed just because Vince was there, and I just didn't understand the point of him. Like, what even is he trying to accomplish here? I guess that's part of my issue, is I don't know what he's trying to accomplish other than just fucking with Steve Austin, but what does that really get him? Is it just... because of his ego, like he just wants to fuck with him.
I think the idea is that he's kind of snapped, right? Like he tried every kind of like normal way he could to get Austin on his side. Now he's just like snapped, and you know he almost fell over after doing a clothesline. Then after the match, Vince, Patterson, Briscoe all try and stomp Austin. They then hold up Austin for Vince. But Austin kicks Vince away, punches Patterson and Briscoe. Dude Love comes out in his suit and tie. He's trying to get to Austin. Then Dustin Runnels comes out to help Austin.
Why does Dustin Runnels and DX come out? Like,
because why? Because Austin is getting beat up by Dude Love, who is the puppet for Vince McMahon. Dustin Runnels says that Vince McMahon caused the destruction of his career, so Dustin Runnels is out there to stop Dude Love, who, if you remember, 2 weeks ago attacked him midway through him trying to do an interview.
Oh, right, okay.
And then the Nation's on the outside, who DX were feuding with after earlier on, so it actually all did make sense. We got this big, fun brawl to end the show. So, because WCW pretty much every week did the big brawl at the end of the show, whereas I feel like WWF do it sparingly enough that when it happens, it's kind of like, oh, loads of people are brawling. Like, it's not every week, which I think is a downfall to WCW, is they would do that so often that it was like, you knew the end of the show was coming when the big brawl happened. It just got so obvious.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, did you...
And it was a fun enough brawl. And, I mean, Austin, one of the other things that struck me in this match, though, is Austin looks super, super strong. Like, we're talking, he is John Cena and Roman Reigns, right? Because Cornette on commentary is even pointing out, this isn't just a handicap tag match for him. Like, you have five members of the Nation of Domination on the outside, and you have Patterson and Briscoe trying to fuck with him, and he's still managing to rally and fight everyone off. I mean, he's basically Braun Strowman. So, is Austin almost just, like, it seems like he's being fucked with, obviously, and has to come back from behind, but I just don't buy him as an underdog when he's able to just beat everyone. Like, he would just about had D'Lo Brown beat in this match.
But isn't it funny how, like, when somebody's over and everybody likes them, it's fine. It's just like when like Roman Reigns is so unliked that even when he's getting killed by Brock Lesnar, people still hate him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a weird thing.
Is interesting because, I mean, it's just if you look at it, like if you step back and go, like, obviously Austin is over and watching him do this stuff is fun, but it's really not dissimilar to anything they're doing with Roman. It's just that people really liked Austin and wanted to see him win, and people really don't like Roman and don't want to see him win.
Which kind of makes sense as to why they're trying it with Roman, because it worked really well with Austin.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Austin had a really good heel run before he became a babyface. So there is that to consider.
Yes, and he rose organically, you know, as the crowd got behind him, almost like they did with Braun Strowman, almost like, you know, I have feelings about that. But
Sandra, where is your thumb this week? Is it down? Is it middle? Is it up? The people want to know.
Okay, so I'm still annoyed with Vince McMahon just being everywhere, and some of the stuff in the middle of this show was absolute shit, but I can't give it a thumbs down because Al Snow is amazing, and I really, really like him, and I think Dude Love has gotten pretty interesting. It's basically Al Snow that makes this a thumbs in the middle for me. essentially.
I think it is a thumbs in the middle show. I think what brings it down a little bit is I get what they were doing with the main event, but I think Vince's the partner was maybe a little bit too far. I think that it could probably have been better if they'd given him like a shit partner who like was trying but couldn't do anything.
See, I expected it to be someone just useless.
Yeah, which would probably have been better. But I thought that there's a ton of other good stuff on the show. I liked the Triple H Owen Hart match. I thought the Undertaker Lawler stuff was really good. But the thing that kind of brought it down for me to a thumbs in the middle was Hawk and Skull, Farouk and Jarrett, the DX stuff going to CNN Center stuff that wasn't that interesting. So yeah, for me it's in the middle this week. Couple of notes though. So they are doing a show at the Sky Dome in Toronto where they are having Vince be the referee for Austin versus Hunter as a kind of dry run for the pay-per-view. So that'll be Vince's first house show appearance as a heel. At this point, they're still thinking that WrestleMania in 1999 might be in Toronto. It ends up being in Philadelphia, but Toronto was one of the rumours. There were also rumours that Too Cold Scorpio was going to join The Nation, but that was not the case. The reason people thought that was because in one of the house shows, Scorpio teamed with Kama, but it was because Mark Henry and D'Lo Brown, who were both supposed to appear, were detained at the border, and since they were detained, Scorpio had to just be in The Nation for the night at a house show.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense for Scorpio to join The Nation at this point. He just joined Terry Funk.
Dustin Rhodes had knee surgery on the 5th of May, so he's going to be out of action for 3 to 4 weeks. Aw, shame.
I mean, sad day, all those Dustin Runnels matches I wanted to see.
X-Pac is due to be back in the ring in June. He'll probably be back for the King of the Ring pay-per-view.
Is he injured or something?
Still from WCW.
Oh, right, okay.
Austin appeared on Off the Record. It's actually on YouTube if you guys want to watch it, but he was... some of the stuff that he said was... they played the tape where Bischoff had been on in February and said that Austin would be a mid-card performer in WCW and that he was a big fish in a small pond in the WWF. And Austin said he didn't believe Bischoff really felt that way because he doesn't believe Bischoff is that stupid and that the numbers don't lie. Raw's current ratings don't lie. I think it was 2 weeks ago, they did a 5.7, which was the highest rating cable history for wrestling. Well, I mean, it wasn't, but modern it was. Right now he's more than doubling the number two guy in WCW. He's right now more than doubling the number two guy in wrestling on merch, which at that time was Goldberg. He said the WWF is the big time and WCW is a place to stay around and get some work. He brought up Bischoff firing him on the phone and said that he didn't have the guts to do it in person. In WCW, he was in a tag team with Brian Pillman. They could have been the best tag team in history, but they were shut down. What else did he say? The Survivor Series was brought up, Austin said that Vince never lied to Brett. At this point, Michael Landsberg jumped in and said that he did, and that he knew he did because Vince was on the show and admitted that he did. Austin then kind of didn't really know what to do because the clip was played of him of Vince saying that he had lied. Austin said that so Austin didn't really know what to do, and he just kind of grumbled and said it was just Vince firing Brett, and that was that. Austin said that he felt the steps should be taken to make things a little bit safer in wrestling. He was asked about Goldberg, he had no problem with him, and felt that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. What else was there? Was there anything else? Says that Diamond Dallas Page is a friend of his and a hard worker called Shawn Michaels, extremely talented, but he started crying at the end. Said it was a lot of fun working with Mike Tyson, he'd still fight him. Said Ric Flair was one of the greatest of all time, but now it's time to hang it up. And that Vince McMahon was a hell of a promoter and close to a genius. So that was him, on Off the Record. So
I think it would be interesting seeing Steve Austin kind of caught and having to be like, oh, I was not aware that he actually admitted to lying. I might have to watch that clip. It sounds kind of interesting.
The headline match for Madison Square Garden on the 5th of June is Austin and The Undertaker against Kane and Dude Love. Be a fun match to watch. And funnily enough, at Unforgiven, Jeff Jarrett was lip syncing. They went in the studio and taped him actually singing and put it on a tape and played it at the show, so he lip-synced his own performance.
Oh, so that was his own performance?
I would assume with the help of autotune, but yes.
Yes, well, obviously, because it really didn't sound like him. So I'm assuming some stuff was, you know, happened to that. I stand by that performance at Unforgiven. I enjoyed it.
There you go. So that's it for us. We're gonna head off into podcast sleep or something. We'll be back on Thursday for
podcast sleep or something.
I don't know. We'll be back on Thursday for the SmackDown summary tomorrow. David and I will be back with the Raw rundown. On Friday, Finn and I will be around with the 1 year anniversary episode of the Power Slam podcast. But it is time to plug Sandra. Plugs.
All right, you can follow me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Follow Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. And for bonus content, all sorts of pay-per-view reviews, retro pay-per-view reviews, hear us talk about Unforgiven, where I get really excited about Sawyer Brown and Kenny doesn't know what I'm talking about. Patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. What else am I missing? I think that's about it. YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for interviews and all of that goodness.
Yeah, that is it. So we're going to play you out with the theme song of The Stalker, the gimmick where Barry Windham was a babyface, where women were screaming in terror as his theme tune came out, but he was coming out to fight heels. So kind of like Roman Reigns, but without the women screaming.
I'll miss you, Barry Windham.
Bye.
Bye.